By statute, convicted sex offenders are required to report their online identifiers, including email addresses, screen names, and user IDs. And failure to report online identifiers is a Class F felony. The Court of Appeals has now upheld the requirement against a First Amendment challenge where the defendant contended the statutes were not sufficiently narrowly tailored to achieve the state's objective of protecting minors online. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Smathers, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina. John, you did a presentation recently about authenticating digital evidence. There was a recent case about Ring doorbell camera footage. Tell us about State v. Butler.
Sure. So State v. Butler is a case we got from the Court of Appeals on March 18th of 2026. This is a case out of Brunswick County. And rather than take a deep dive into the facts right off the top, I think we'll talk about those maybe kind of as they fit into the different issues that are being raised on appeal. But just to give an overview of what we're talking about, it's an incident that happened back on September 14th of 2023. There are four people there, two men, two women, who are sort of hanging out near a house. They're drinking and socializing, but eventually that turns into arguing. And then that sort of escalates ultimately into an assault where the defendant is assaulting the victim, punching him in the face and in the head, causing some injuries. And then the defendant gets into the passenger seat of a truck and one of the women who's there drives away in the truck, but in the course of doing so, drives over the victim's leg, causing further injuries to that same victim. So the defendant is charged with one count of assault inflicting serious bodily injury. He has a jury trial on that in May of 2024 and is convicted of that offense. So there's a number of issues that he is now challenging on appeal. And the first one of those is this issue of him being convicted of causing serious bodily injury. He says that his motion to dismiss back in the trial court should have been granted, that the evidence that was offered by the state would only support a finding that the victim, Tim, suffered serious injury, not serious bodily injury. I will tell you now, the injuries he suffered, the victim suffered from the initial part of the assault, was a closed fracture of his right orbit, a closed right maxillary fracture, a left parietal scalp hematoma. He was released from the hospital the next day and given some pain medication and recommended for outpatient follow-up. So the trial court allowed that to go to the jury as assault inflicting serious bodily injury. But the Court of Appeals takes a different view on this. They sort of review, okay, what exactly has our case law established as the standard for that? And they review from some of the case law that serious bodily injury means an injury that creates a substantial risk of death or that causes serious permanent disfigurement, coma, a permanent or protracted condition that causes extreme pain, or permanent or protracted loss or impairment of the function of any bodily member or organ, or that results in prolonged hospitalization. So in other words, making a showing of serious bodily injury requires some injury that is more serious than serious injury. And they explain that, you know, the General Assembly created this category of assault to sort of cover that higher level of injury that is happening here. But looking at the evidence that the state presented, the Court of Appeals says that was not sufficiently shown in this case. They look at the case law being cited by the state, but say that those can be distinguished from what we have here, that the evidence in this case didn't meet that criteria for serious bodily injury. We just don't have evidence of things like a prolonged hospitalization or a substantial risk of death, loss or impairment of a bodily organ, permanent protracted condition, because as disturbing as those kind of medical terms sound, they dig into it a little bit deeper and say, yes, he was taken to the hospital that night and he was treated, but he was released the next day and he was prescribed painkillers, but then he never felt like it was necessary to fill that prescription. And he testified that the pain was actually gone after a day or two with some bruises that lasted for up to a week. And so he had no real lasting effect from his injuries. So they distinguish that from, you know, what we've seen in other cases that have said this is sufficient to cause serious bodily injury. And they review a number of them, State versus Fields, State versus Brown, State versus Williams, where, you know, the victims did suffer these kinds of permanent disfigurements or protracted periods of pain or impairment of a bodily function. This should not really have, in their view, should not have gone to the jury. Now, they say those specific injuries, like that they list out in these other cases, Fields and Brown and the others, they make a point of saying the specific injuries in those precedent cases should not be used as measuring posts for determining whether the evidence before us is sufficient to support a finding of serious bodily injury. The question is whether a reasonable juror could find the evidence in the record, taken in the light most favorable to the state, sufficient to conclude that Tim's injuries caused a substantial risk of all those things that we have just mentioned.
Jonathan, but, could you tell from the opinion whether the defendant requested an instruction on the lesser included offense? Because it seems like this issue could come up in one of two different circumstances, right? I mean, it could be presented as a failure of the trial court to submit this lesser included offense to the jury, or it could come up as a failure of the state's evidence to prove the greater offense. But it sounds like in this case, it's framed as a question of the sufficiency of the evidence of the greater offense. Is that right?
So, Joe, I think this is basically framed on appeal as a, you know, sufficiency of the evidence question. The defendant made a motion to dismiss, saying that this should not go to the jury on assault inflicting serious bodily injury. And the trial judge did submit it that way. That is what the jury returned. Now the Court of Appeals is saying, we don't think that it rose to that level. And so the remedy that's ultimately imposed by the Court of Appeals here is to remand it back down to the trial court for entry of judgment on the lesser offense of assault inflicting serious injury. In other words, the jury did certainly at least find that, but they view it as being a legal error to submit it to the jury on that more serious type of injury. The second issue that's raised on appeal ultimately ends up kind of being moot. The defendant is arguing that the trial court further erred by allowing in some additional evidence of the injuries that were inflicted on the defendant's leg. But, you know, this defendant was not the one driving the truck. And so he said that would have been prejudicial. The jury may have found serious bodily injury based on the evidence of the leg injury that was admitted. But the Court of Appeals sort of dispenses with that by saying, well, we've already rejected that this was serious bodily injury. So that sort of becomes an irrelevant issue. The third point on appeal is the one you flagged in the introduction, Joe, this Ring camera video. You know, I mentioned in the overview, this is four people who are near a home. There is a Ring camera installed at that home. And so the Ring camera captured some, but not all of what happened in the case. The Ring camera ultimately captured, I believe it was a total of 1 minute and 40 seconds of what happened during a 6 minute and 24 second time period in which this assault and all of these incidents are happening. Those videos are offered at trial, and the defendant is making an argument that those videos should not have been admitted, that they weren't properly authenticated under the standards that we have for that. So, you know, Joe, you and I, we've talked about a number of cases on video recently, and that's sort of what I think you were mentioning in the introduction. We've had Jones, Winseth, Leggett, these really interesting cases lately talking about authenticating video in different ways as business records or under 901b4 distinctive characteristics. This is more of a traditional foundation approach and a traditional challenge to it. The defendant is essentially saying that the witnesses offered by the state, such as the homeowner or law enforcement, they're just not able to say that the videos introduced at trial were identical to the ones that were produced by the Ring camera. That's kind of part one. And the court rejects that. The homeowner, Laura, said there was no way for her to modify these clips. She just handed her phone over to the detective. The detective said that he used his phone camera to record all these video clips. So, you know, there was sufficient evidence for an authentication purpose to show that these are the same ones from the camera. And then the second part of that was a challenge from the defendant saying, you know, under this more traditional approach to authenticating videos, somebody's got to come in and say that the recording process was reliable. And here again, the Court of Appeals says, I think we get there. I mean, not that Laura or the detective necessarily knows the precise technology of how the Ring camera works, but same way that we would talk about testimony from a loss prevention officer at a Walmart, they can at least testify that the Ring camera was working on the night in question. It records video when it detects motion. These are those copies of those same videos. I think really what the defendant's objection to here is the Ring camera was just recording these 10-second clips, right? That's why we only have this 1 minute and 40 seconds out of this whole 6 minute and 24 second time period. And so the defendant is sort of attacking the reliability of the videos based on that. You know, how can we trust this camera that's recording for 10 seconds and then not recording for 20 and then recording for 10 but not recording for 20? You know, shouldn't that make us doubt the reliability of the videos? But the Court of Appeals, I think, correctly says, really, the question is, the videos that we do have, right, the times that the camera was recording in those 10-second clips, was it working properly then? And are those the same videos that are being introduced into evidence now? And the Court of Appeals says yes. In other words, to quote, a gap in the footage does not indicate the video is not what it purports to be. In other words, the video we do have is sufficiently reliable, so it was properly admitted. But yeah, I agree with what you said in the introduction. I think this is something that's going to come up a lot, and I think it's a good case for prosecutors to reference when we have these kind of gaps or errors in the video. Doesn't mean we throw the whole thing out. We can still establish that the video we do have, that we have sufficiently authenticated and should be allowed to admit into evidence. The fourth issue here was dealing with a flight instruction that was given to the jury. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on that. There was a different person driving the truck as it sped away from the scene and was then found in a field the next morning. The defendant was not the driver, so his jury should not have been instructed on flight. But the Court of Appeals says that that was a proper call for the judge to make, that he wasn't driving, but he immediately got in it after concluding the first part of the assault that he did and allowed this other person, Nicole, to drive away, which she did quickly and recklessly. So that was supported.
I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, if that's true, that the defendant has to be the conductor of the vehicle. Anybody that hopped on a train or an airplane couldn't get a flight instruction because they say, I wasn't responsible for where the vehicle was going.
Exactly. I didn't flee to Switzerland. I wasn't the pilot of the plane. I think that's the way they're looking at it. I mean, you were the one who stepped on the plane, just like he was the one that jumped in the car and then willingly sped away from the scene. So they felt like it was proper to instruct the jury on flight. The last one, Joe, and this is something you and I think have talked about, kind of an interesting take on this Castle Doctrine approach, because one of the details we haven't really discussed yet is as this assault unfolded, the victim actually was pulling that woman out of the truck, right? So he's removed her from the vehicle. They're having this sort of argument or encounter, and that's when the defendant steps in and assaults the victim. And so he is arguing that the trial court erred by declining to instruct the jury on Castle Doctrine, defense of a motor vehicle, right? We've got somebody who is, you know, forcefully removing and assaulting a person in a vehicle. He's then stepping in, he would argue, to her defense. Shouldn't I get an instruction on Castle Doctrine, defense of a vehicle? And the Court of Appeals says no, that, you know, he is not in that vehicle. They explain the defendant was not in the motor vehicle when Tim forcibly entered it, and therefore he was not an occupant for purposes of section 14-51.2.
Hold on a second. We had a recent case from the Court of Appeals, a case called Williams, that says that you don't have to be within the vehicle to exercise the right of an occupant, right? How does the Court of Appeals get around Williams?
Yeah, I think that's what makes this case really interesting, Joe. You're right. Williams, I think you talked about it on this podcast not that long ago, where the person was assaulted in the car and then sort of in the course of trying to flee from the assault, steps out of the car and the assault continues and then used deadly force outside the vehicle. They said that was part of the ongoing assault, right? That he didn't forfeit his right to defend himself just because as part of defending himself, he gets out of the vehicle. But that's just not what applies under the Court of Appeals analysis to this person who he was not himself in the vehicle. Now, to be clear, they just noted in footnote 4, the jury was instructed on defense of another, right? You know, just sort of a regular self-defense analysis. But Joe, I think you're exactly right. In terms of Castle Doctrine, they say this is not Williams because he's not the one in the car. They say, unlike in Williams, however, in this case, defendant was not inside the motor vehicle at the time of an unlawful and forceful entry of the vehicle by another person. He approached the vehicle only after Tim had removed Nicole's from the driver's seat. Therefore, he is not an occupant of the motor vehicle and therefore was not entitled to this Castle Doctrine
defense. So if Nicole had turned around and attacked the victim, right, if the woman who was in the car had then pulled out a gun and shot him, we'd be squarely within Williams territory, right?
I think so. I think if it was part of the same ongoing assault and then she pulled a gun out of her waistband, I think her attorney certainly would be pointing at Williams and saying, this is right here, Castle Doctrine.
But because the defendant was not the one who had been in the vehicle, he doesn't take on the right to use defensive force that Nicole presumably would have under 14-51.2.
Right. I mean, there isn't a whole lot of other discussion than that about, you know, why does defense of others not apply the same way other than sort of what we've already read out, which is the Court of Appeals saying, we take the statute as it's written, and the statute says it applies if you're the occupant, the end. And he was not the occupant. He was just somebody who stepped in afterwards. And so they conclude that he should not be covered. Now, having had this lengthy discussion about the case, I will tell everybody that there is a stay that was issued in this case by the North Carolina Supreme Court on April 6th. That was done on motion by the state for a temporary stay. I don't know exactly what they're going to argue or what parts of this they're going to challenge, but you know, it may be because there was a dissent in this case. Judge Murphy would have decided this a little bit differently on that serious bodily injury issue. Judge Murphy disagrees with the majority's conclusion about why it's not sufficient. There's an interesting part in the dissent where the judge says, the majority suggests we are to determine whether the result of the injuries included a risk of death or protracted condition causing extreme pain, regardless of the extent of the victim's injuries. But I would hold that the jury, sitting as the fact finder, can do so in light of the extent of the victim's injuries. In other words, the injury you cause, I guess, may have led to these things, right? I mean, you know, it could carry a risk of death when you are breaking multiple bones in a person's face and, you know, busting the top of their head open. Those are things that he would say is a jury question. And we don't just necessarily look at it after the fact about what was the actual result. We just let the jury decide that in light of the actual result, but it's their call to make. So we'll see if the Supreme Court has something different they want to say about that.
The second case we had on today was State v. Smathers. This is a case out of Buncombe County testing the constitutionality under the First Amendment of this requirement that registered sex offenders report online identifiers. The facts of this case were back in 2010. Defendant was convicted of taking indecent liberties with a child and became subject to sex offender registration requirements. In December of 2022, defendant was released from prison, that is, on other charges, and visited the Buncombe County Sheriff's Department to register as he was required to do. The office notified the defendant at the time that he was required to provide his online identifiers. Defendant reported two online identifiers, a Gmail address and a Grindr account. In June of 2023, so about 6 months later, a probation officer conducting a warrantless search of defendant's phone found two social media applications with reportable online identifiers, a Grindr account and a Snapchat account. Defendant's Snapchat account was created in January of 2023, so after he was required to register. Asked if he had reported this account, defendant said he meant to and he was probably going to do it later that day. And of course, defendant admitted that he was using the Snapchat account to send pictures of his penis. Defendant was arrested and charged with failure to report online identifiers and with habitual felon status. At trial, he moved to dismiss the substantive charge on First Amendment grounds. The trial court denied that motion. Defendant was convicted of all charges, and then he appealed to the Court of Appeals. So before the Court of Appeals, defendant is arguing that the provisions requiring him to report online identifiers are unconstitutional. The Court of Appeals recognized that the First Amendment protects anonymous speech, and it said laws that chill speech are subject to scrutiny. Recent case from the United States Supreme Court, Packingham v. North Carolina, held also that the protections of the First Amendment apply to the internet, what the Court of Appeals called a major forum for the exchange of ideas. Packingham, remember, was that case where the North Carolina legislature had passed a law banning sex offenders from the use of any social media. That went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court found that law unconstitutional under the First Amendment. There are a number of state statutes at issue in this case, Smathers. I'm going to go through these quickly, but what follows doesn't make a lot of sense without some familiarity with the different provisions of state law that are at issue here. Under 14-208.7, a person required to register as a sex offender is required as part of that registration to report any online identifier that the person uses or intends to use. An online identifier is defined at General Statute 14-208.6 as an email address, instant message screen name, user ID, chat, or other internet communication name, but it does not include social security number, date of birth, or PIN number. Under 14-208.9, if a person required to register changes an online identifier or obtains a new online identifier, that person shall, within 10 days, notify the sheriff. And then failure to report an online identifier, a new online identifier, or a change to existing online identifiers is a Class F felony. And that's the charge that this defendant was charged with. And then another provision of these statutes, online identifiers are released to the public in one of three ways. The sheriff or the Department of Public Safety may release information necessary to protect the public concerning a specific person. The second way is that any person may obtain the registration forms by submitting a written request to the sheriff. And then third, DPS may release that information to an entity. I take that to mean internet service providers for pre-screening purposes and to comply with their reporting obligations. So the first question here was whether these reporting requirements even implicated First Amendment protections at all.
Sort of the first thing I was wondering about, Joe, and I think a lot of people are as well, right? Because this is not, like, per Packingham, this is not saying you are forbidden from getting on the internet or speaking, right? It just says we need you to tell us that you are account Smathers123 on this social media site. So, I mean, how is that restricting speech to just say we need to know who you are?
Yeah, there's two different kind of components to that. The first is that the Court of Appeals recognized that laws that have a potential chilling effect on a person's speech do implicate First Amendment protections. And the second prong of that is that the Court of Appeals recognized that people have a right to speak anonymously, and that right extends even to sex offenders. So this implicates the person's right to speak anonymously because they have to provide their pseudonym, essentially, to the sheriff, to Department of Public Safety. The Court of Appeals said that this has a potential chilling effect on a sex offender's use of the internet to engage in meaningful speech. So that's why they find the First Amendment is implicated by these provisions. So the second question they go on to address is the appropriate level of scrutiny. Under that First Amendment jurisprudence, content-based restrictions on speech face strict scrutiny, whereas content-neutral restrictions are subject only to intermediate scrutiny. Here, the reporting requirement is content-neutral. It has no dependence on what the online identifier is, doesn't ultimately keep a sex offender from saying anything online. So the Court of Appeals said that these were content-neutral, and it determined that it would apply intermediate scrutiny. So the next analysis it conducts, the Court of Appeals says these restrictions on speech are valid if they are narrowly tailored to serve a significant government interest. So those are kind of the two elements of this moving forward, whether they're narrowly tailored and whether they serve a significant government interest. To address that significant government interest portion first, the defendant apparently didn't even contest the fact that these laws do serve a significant state interest. The Court of Appeals had no hesitation in concluding that the state has a compelling interest in safeguarding the physical and psychological well-being of minors. With these laws, it noted, the legislature identified its concern that community protection was impaired by a lack of information available to law enforcement about convicted offenders. So the Court of Appeals concluded that the state has demonstrated that the statutes further the stated goal of alleviating an information shortage that hinders crime prevention. As far as the government interest is concerned, that's pretty much goes without saying. So the real contest here is whether these statutes were sufficiently narrowly tailored to serve that government interest. Defendant argued that the statutes were overbroad and not narrowly tailored. He specifically raised three different arguments. One, that the statutes are categorical and sweep up too much lawful online activity. Two, that there's no exception for offenders who never engaged in the online activity sought to be deterred. And three, that there's no meaningful limitation on law enforcement's use or public release of the online identifiers. The Court of Appeals first summarily rejected defendant's second argument, that is, that there's no exception for offenders who didn't commit crimes online, declaring that the legislature is not required to make exceptions for offenders who did not use the internet to facilitate their crimes. The Court of Appeals concluded that the reporting requirements are not overbroad, at least in the number or categories of offenders to which they apply. So then with regard to the release of the online identifiers, the Court of Appeals did note that the defendant's argument that the release of online identifiers could chill permissible speech was both plausible and well-grounded. That is to say, that particular argument that the defendant made was worth a little more discussion. Still, the Court of Appeals ultimately rejected the defendant's argument for the reasons that it explains further moving forward. And here's where it goes into the arguments that the state made that these requirements were narrowly tailored to address the state's interest. The state argued that the amount of speech deterred or chilled is neither substantial nor disproportionate. The Court of Appeals agreed with the state that Packingham, that's the case holding sex offenders can't use social media at all, is distinguishable from the facts here. The reporting requirements at issue in this case do not categorically prohibit sex offenders from speaking on the internet. And ultimately, the Court of Appeals said disclosure requirements have been found to be a less restrictive alternative to more comprehensive regulations. So the Court of Appeals noted that the internet is not the only place that a person can express views anonymously, right? Newspapers are still available, handing out handbills on the street corner. So ultimately, these restrictions on sex offenders' use of the internet were appropriately tailored. The state also invited the Court of Appeals to adopt a narrowing construction on the term user IDs. That's a term that was used in the definition of online identifiers. The state asked the Court of Appeals to construe that term to focus on identifiers that enable private person-to-person communication. The Court of Appeals rejected that invitation, finding the term user ID to be unambiguous. It noted, however, that offenders must report only their current online identifiers, not covering names that they used to speak in the past. And then finally, the state argued that the public disclosure provisions confirm this sort of narrow tailoring of the restrictions. The Court of Appeals found that the release to private companies, including social media applications, is essential to communication and information gathering that protects minors online. So those are sufficiently narrowly tailored. With regard to the public disclosure provisions, the Court of Appeals said those pose a closer question, but the Court of Appeals was satisfied that they are sufficiently narrowly tailored to allow a constitutional application of those provisions. The Court of Appeals concluded that the requirement as to online identifiers cover neither too much activity nor too many offenders, and the public disclosure provisions impose sufficient limits on the release of that information. So the Court of Appeals was satisfied that the reporting requirements are facially constitutional. It rejected the defendant's First Amendment challenge to these statutes.
Joe, it's a pretty dense opinion, but I mean, I guess the takeaway for our prosecutors, hopefully we would say, is not terribly surprising, right? I mean, that yes, it is limiting their freedom of speech to some extent, but that they're concluding based on how it's written and the actual effect that it has, yes, it is curtailing their freedom of speech, but narrowly tailored to serve a significant government interest and leaves open these other channels. So, I mean, would you expect any further challenge to that statute, or should this pretty much close it for
us? Yeah, that's kind of the interesting question going forward, is whether there are other provisions of that sex offense registration that still might be subject to a First Amendment challenge. I think this is an important case, at least in narrowing the potential scope of Packingham, because moving forward after Packingham, defendants could make the argument that, look, we have a right to use the internet just like anybody else, so any government restriction on that use is going to be unconstitutional. This case kind of pulls back from that argument, says, no, an absolute restriction that bars you from speaking on the internet absolutely is going to be unconstitutional. That does not mean that the state can't put significant limitations on your ability to use the internet, particularly when we know that that's a popular forum for soliciting other illegal activity.
Right. If we can show that it's narrowly tailored and serves this important interest, then it would uphold.
Precisely.
So then our last case was State versus Sloan. This is another one from March 18th of 2026. This is a case out of Mecklenburg County, and it's primarily dealing with some issues of joinder and 404B evidence. The overview, again, of the facts are that the victim in the case was the subject of two assaults by the defendant, who was her ex-boyfriend and the mother of their child. The first happened back on June 21st of 2021, when she was at a friend's home and the defendant showed up, jumped out of the bushes, was threatening her with a firearm, physically assaulting her, and making comments that he was going to kill her. She reported that incident to the police. The second one happened 8 days later on June 29th of 2021. This time she was sitting in a car outside of her parents' house when, again, the defendant showed up in a vehicle, approached her with a gun, was telling her to get out and get into his car, threatening her, threatening her family. She, rather than getting into his car, made a run for the house, and he opened fire, shot multiple times, and there were some bullet holes in the home, and actually the victim's brother suffered a bullet wound to the leg. And so, of course, police were notified and responded. Based on those two incidents, the defendant was indicted for, in the first incident, assault on a female, communicating threats, firearm by felon, and a common law robbery. And for the second incident, indicted for possession of firearm by felon, assault with deadly weapon, intent to kill, inflicting serious injury, and five other charges, including discharging a firearm into occupied dwelling. State moved to join those two matters for trial. The defendant objected to that, but the trial court allowed it, finding it was appropriate to join the two for trial in this particular case. Based on that ruling, the defendant actually pled then to the charges from the first incident, so he was only going to trial on the charges for the second incident from 8 days later. Relevant to our discussion, he is ultimately convicted of all the indictments and sentenced to multiple consecutive active sentences totaling somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 months. But two things relevant to the issues that come up on appeal. The first of those is that in the time between the initial incidents and then ultimately getting to trial, it is relevant that the victim at one point recants her allegations against the defendant, but then sort of recants her recantation and verifies that it did happen the way that she said. So, of course, she is cross-examined about that to some extent. And then relevant to that issue, there are a number of text messages that the trial judge has to decide how much will be allowed and how much will not. These are text messages from the victim and to the victim dealing with the defendant and then also his new girlfriend, essentially showing some animosity between them, which the defense would argue was grounds for bias. So there are these four issues that come up on appeal, but really these are the two that are significant. And the first of those are these text messages, because again, the judge allowed some of these text messages to come in for the defense, but not all. The defense wanted to cross-examine the victim about these text messages that she sent to this other woman who was sort of a romantic partner with the defendant as well. The trial judge excluded some of those on the grounds of relevancy and saying they were only going to be introduced for inflammatory purposes. And the defendant is arguing that they should have been allowed to offer all of those as showing the victim's motive, you know, for for fabricating some testimony or offering false testimony about what the defendant's involvement in all of that was. To clarify what we're talking about, the trial court denied the defendant's request to question the victim about some of the text messages she sent to this other woman, Grant. But these were things that were not just directly between the two women, but these were things more like name calling of the other woman's baby, for example, you know, text messages that said that the baby looked like a crackhead and the baby's hair won't grow. And, you know, so the judge said those kind of things are crossing the line into just being irrelevant and inflammatory. But it's important to understand that the court did allow other text messages to come in that were more directly related to showing the victim's ill will towards the defendant or towards this other woman, Grant, or that, you know, indicated that this other person might be lying. The Court of Appeals says the exclusion of those sort of inflammatory, irrelevant, you know, literally baby name-calling text messages didn't prevent the jury from hearing the defendant's theory of the victim's motive for accusing him. In other words, she's just angry at him about his relationship with this other woman. And furthermore, the victim was extensively cross-examined about this at the trial and admitted to exchanging these other text messages with the woman between 2021 and 2023, and even admitted calling her really mean, hateful, nasty names and, you know, sending these photographs like a firearm and stuff like that. So the Court of Appeals ultimately concludes that the text messages that were excluded didn't rise to that level of preventing the defendant from putting on their defense or making their case. And that's sort of a distinction they draw between some of these other cases like State versus Peterson or State versus Shannon. You know, this is not where the defense is saying, but I have to tell the jury this part too, or else, you know, they don't get the whole story, right? It doesn't, we got to complete the story of the crime or explain the motivation. And it says here, you know, these text messages, some of these are 2 years after the crime are committed. They're unnecessary, cumulative, prejudicial, inflammatory, that the defense was able to make their point about attacking this victim's motive and recanting of her testimony at one point. So no error, they say, there excluding some of those messages. The other issue that's being raised, the significant one on appeal, is dealing with this question of joinder and 404B. You know, remember, the trial court allowed the state's motion for joinder, then the defendant pled out to the first. And so they're evaluating whether that was the correct decision that the trial court made. And here they say it was. You know, the defense tries to raise this issue talking about some of the differences between the two incidents. And the Court of Appeals flips that back the other way and says, look at the similarities between these two incidents, right? I mean, if we've got the same victim being attacked by the same defendant in pretty much the same way, 8 days apart, using firearms, making these threats, that there's a pretty clear similarity between what's going on. So they say it was proper for the court to allow joinder, that, you know, these were more than sufficient findings were made by the trial court. Related to this is this question of 404B, because remember also the defendant ultimately pled out to the first set of charges. So we're only going to trial on the second set of charges, and yet the state offered evidence of that first incident as 404B. And so the defendant is arguing, well, if nothing else, that should be error. Right? I pled to those charges. Why am I still being essentially tried for them, even though they're not before the jury to decide? And the Court of Appeals applies that same analysis that we see from joinder, looking at the similarity. They mentioned the analysis that was done by the trial judge. Both of these things occurred as the defendant found and approached the victim in front of a home where she was staying, made demands of the victim as he approached her, utilized violence to try to gain control of her, utilized a firearm to threaten and intimidate her, you know, whether it was a friend or a family member. These similarities, they say, supported the initial finding of joinder, and essentially for the same reason, it was proper to allow that evidence to come in as 404B. It was necessary to show not the defendant's propensity to commit the crime, but to show his intent, his motive, his modus operandi, and to show the identity of the defendant as the perpetrator of the later June 29th incident, just like he was for the earlier June 21st incident.
So, Jonathan, I understand the 404B challenge because that evidence of the prior assault came in during the trial of the later assault. I'm having difficulty with the joinder issue because, I mean, he pled out to the first set of charges. The fact that they were joined for trial, they weren't ultimately tried together. So, like, what prejudice could he possibly show from a joinder that never resulted in a joint trial?
Yeah, right. I mean, they just say that they are reviewing the trial judge's determination of that de novo to see if there was this sufficient transactional connection that would have justified it. But I take your point, Joe. I mean, you know, this ruling was made, but then, you know, he did not actually proceed to trial on both of those, I would say, to preserve that error, right? He's pleading that out, presumably arguing that that was improper. So even setting that aside, you know, I think we kind of get to the same place on the joinder or the 404B evidence, right? About, you know, whether it was improper given that he had pled out these others. And I think, you know, he just would support that by arguing, I don't know, I guess I only pled out the first because of the joinder and, you know, trying to limit the what the jury was going to hear. And now that's kind of blown up in my face, right? Because I'm here I am. I've already pled guilty to half of them. And yet the jury's still hearing about everything. And I think that's what he's asking the Court of Appeals to find was error. But in this case, with all the similarities between the two, they say that there was not. There's two other issues that are raised on appeal. He's trying to make an argument that the felon in possession charge is unconstitutional, but they find that that was not preserved. And so they're not really going to address that in this case. I would just say we've had a number of cases recently that have gone the state's way on that anyway. I don't know what the outcome would have been, but we're waiting on a few of those to be resolved by the Supreme Court. So that's one we'll keep an eye on going forward. The final issue in the case is just dealing with a clerical error. I think there was a mistake made on the judgment and commitment paperwork where they're saying that those discharging firearm offenses were Class E's and they should have been marked as being Class D's. So it's a remand back down to the trial court just to fix that paperwork and make sure that it accurately reflects what he was convicted of.
Well, that's all for today. In this episode, we discussed State v. Butler, finding insufficient evidence of serious bodily injury to support a conviction for assault inflicting serious bodily injury. State v. Smathers, upholding the statutory requirement that sex offenders report online identifiers against a First Amendment challenge. And State v. Sloan, concluding that the trial court did not err by excluding certain text messages as unnecessarily cumulative. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We are coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in beautiful Chapel Hill. Special thanks to our producer, Paul Bonner, and to Gustav Holtz for our music. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, concerns, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Sounds good, Joe. Thanks. Hope it helped.